Health and Human Services Committee to order Tuesday, March 6th. We have a long day today, folks, and so hopefully be seeing a lot of you. We have meetings tonight also. We first have Senator Nenow's Senate File 1699, the Group Residential Housing Supplemental Aid Shelter Needy Provisions and Adult Foster Care Homes Provisions Modifications. Senator Nenow, take your time. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have an amendment that I would like to offer up, but before we offer that amendment, staff has got some changes that need to be made to that. I believe it's the A3. So if we could have staff explain to us those changes, and I would offer the A3 with those changes incorporated.
Absolutely. That's being passed out. Does anybody want to explain the amendment? Is it just technical changes or substantial changes that will affect the fiscal note?
Well, it is a delete all amendment, Madam Chair. I offer that as an author's amendment, and then we can get into the description of the bill as amended.
Senator Nenow, the fiscal note that we have in front of us is drafted to the A3 amendment.
That is my understanding, yes.
Yes. Okay. Senator Nenow moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Madam Chair?
Yep.
Madam Chair, we need to incorporate some changes that staff will...
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 8, the units 2 through 7 need to be changed slightly, the language on the line. So line, page 8, line 28, where it says recognize, it should read ability to recognize. Line 29 should read ability to manage. Line 30 should read ability to meet. Line 32 should read ability to self-administer. Line 33 should read ability to obtain. And line 34 should read ability to recognize.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Are we putting ability to in front of every item?
Mr. LeBaco.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, that is correct.
Then why don't we put it at the on line 8.26 before the semicolon, so then it works with each one of them.
So LeBaco.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, you'll see on line 25. Madam Chair, Senator, I see what you're saying.
You got the hawk watching you here. So Senator Higgins, the hawk, and she,
the hawk.
She's got this down.
Page 6.
It'll work. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, then the amendment would be on line 26, after equipment, insert ability to colon.
Well, now where does it go? 24. It's line 24.
Yes. Mr.
LeBaco? Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, then line 25 will need to be changed to read
so everything but one has it.
I see where your problem is. Okay.
All right. What you're going to do.
Back to the ability to in half a dozen places.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, on lines 28, 29, 30, 32, 33, and 34, those sentences will start out ability to. Continuing on page 12, line 25, simply striking the word is or removing the word is. Page 15, line 3, after the word chairs, insert and ranking minority members. And finally, on page 18, line 9, where it says 256B.0913, should read 256B.4913. Madam Chair.
Members, would you like that repeated? Are we clear with that? Okay, Senator Nenow moves the A3 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Nenow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a proposal from ARRM, which we're referring to. Bring the microphone close.
Please.
There. There we go. referred to as the Blueprint for Reform. This is precipitated by many different things. Those on this and challenges. Those on this committee are very familiar with the difficulties that exist with funding and bureaucracies, et cetera, et cetera. This bill is an attempt to get to some significant changes. You know, I've got a bunch of bullet point overview, but for the sake of time, since we started a little bit late, I think I'm just going to let this go on to the proponents and the testifiers and let them speak to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Nidau. That'd be fine.
Welcome. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM.
Mr. Nelson, could you please pull the microphone close? Thank you.
About a year ago, ARM began to put together this blueprint, recognizing that the funding for services is now constituted primarily in corporate foster care is unsustainable. And so we sought to find savings within corporate foster care for those who need that level of service, recognizing there are some people who are overserved in corporate foster care. And therefore, looking at the barriers that inhibit people from moving out to other community services and ways to facilitate innovation, really in both worlds, corporate foster care and in other settings. One of the chief barriers that you're going to see is housing and how housing money works. And this proposal basically keeps the housing money budget neutral but opens up the way it can be used, because people do need to have a roof. And in doing that, facilitating more movement to less expensive services that more fit the individual needs of people and on a more outcome-based and quality-based way. In essence, I know time is very limited, but that is what the bill does. Since the bill, we did consult with other folks in the disability world and in government as we were putting it together, but particularly since the bill was introduced. We've had many, many discussions with advocates, the ARC of Minnesota, Disability Law Center, NAMI. We've started, now we're talking more in depth with counties. And we've worked on language with the Department of Human Services Licensing Division and the Continuing Care Division, and also with the State Council on Disability. So with that, Madam Chair, if I may, I'll start out with Section 1. With me is Barb Turner, our Chief Operating Officer, and who is more knowledgeable than I on many of the program segments, and then Craig Weber, our chief fiscal analyst, will talk about one of the incentive sections. The first section,
Mr. Nelson.
Yes, ma'am.
Would this bill apply to a program that is down in Fairmont called the Odyssey? Are you familiar with that?
No.
Where they're? Okay. Well, we can talk about that further. I'm sorry.
Okay. We'll go through the sections as briefly but as completely as possible. The first section is a new item in the bill that came from the National Alliance on Mental Illness and is a major part of a bill authored by Senator Lori. Senator Hahn is the second author. And really what this does is it allows providers to get certification in corporate foster care when they're serving people with mental illness as a primary diagnosis. It's voluntary, but it should help in a marketplace, which is what this bill is trying to create more and more, of providers who have the certification, and people can recognize that and have a good housekeeping seal, if you will. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Turner for the next few sections.
Hi, I'm Barb Turner with
Welcome,
ARM.
Ms. Turner. Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to Section 2. Section 2 deals with two things. It, first of all, extends the ability that was put into law back in 2009 for the ability for providers to license adult foster care homes for 5 people. And one of the requirements, or one of the things that was necessary, was for the department to make a change to their waiver plan in order to be able to pay for, bill for, 5-bed adult foster care programs. That has not yet been done for the DD waiver or for the CAC waiver, and so the end date of providers being able to implement that has come and gone, and we are looking for an extension so that that request can be completed to CMS and people can have this option. So that's what is included in this section. In addition, we have language that would allow those programs that have a fifth bed option to use a bed for respite services without having to have a whole lot of extra hoops to jump through, and to be able to use staffing that's currently in place as long as it does not reduce the level of staffing. So, for example, when somebody goes home for a weekend, someone else may come in and do respite, and we don't need to bring in additional staff. We can utilize the existing staff because there's still only four people actually receiving services at one time.
Madam Chair, excuse me.
Senator Higgins?
Do you want questions as we're going through or at the end?
I think probably at the end, Senator Higgins. And I know Mr. Lebeko would like to say something. Would you like to say something right now?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd just like to point out that the date change on lines 3.14 and 3.15 were also made in the DHS policy bill that came out of committee last week, Senate File 1804. And that bill had changed the dates to 2014. So I'd just like to... Let everybody be aware of that. Thank you.
Right. And just to confirm, we have had discussion with the department, and they were aware of our dates and were fine. They weren't going to change in their bill, but we're fine with the dates that we put into our bill. Section 3 has to do with some clarification on variances for adult overnight supervision in adult foster care programs. Currently, there's been some delays in people going through the process of obtaining those licenses. And so though, what this does is better clarifies who is ineligible, exactly who would be ineligible to receive that alternative license. And it kind of ties into then section number 4, which directs the commissioner to develop an actual application with a checklist so that providers would know exactly what is required in order to obtain the license, and also put in some place some timelines by which the commissioner must act on an application and get back to providers who are applying for that alternative license. Section 5 addresses risk management as it is in currently in 245B. This is language that we work with the Department on Licensing Division. And basically, currently, there's a lot of things that are dealt with as vulnerabilities for an individual simply because it's a disability. And we're trying to have language that better clarifies it's the management of issues, not necessarily just having an issue. So, for example, if you have an allergy, but you're able to manage it with medication and you stay away from whatever makes you have issues, then that would not be something that would have to be included in a risk management plan. So it just tries to simplify and really target those things that are issues for people rather than everything under the sun. Section 6 has to do with provider penalties. This happens, what happened a couple years ago is the federal OIG came in and did an audit on some providers, and one of the requirements is that people need to have a service plan in place, and services are provided based on that service plan. Providers make requests for the service plan from the counties, and oftentimes they don't receive updated service plans, but they continue to provide services because the option would be to discharge somebody. The OIG came in and noted that potentially we were paying people for doing things that they weren't actually authorized to do because the service plan wasn't in place. The provider actually has no control other than making a request for the plan, and if they don't get it, they make another request, and that's kind of all they can do. And so we just want we want providers not to be able to be fined or held accountable for something that's not in their control in regards to that plan. In Section 7, we're addressing background studies. Currently, people who have background studies in licensed settings do not need to have an annual renewal of a background study, but people who are doing services in unlicensed settings need an annual renewal. Again, we work with the department on this language so that both those employees would be dealt with similarly, so that there would not need to be an annual renewal as long as the individual worked at least 40 hours a year in a licensed program. And that ties into Section 8, which clarifies some responsibilities for probation and correction officers. And that has to do with the fact that they need to report, they need to ask and then report if people who have been convicted have worked in health care situations. And so those two things link together, and that's how licensing division gets some information on folks who have had background studies and may be in the court system. Section 9 has to, again, addresses individual service plans. Currently, teams often have meetings and discuss changes in services to individuals, new goals, what have you. And oftentimes, the individual service plan is not updated to reflect those changes that were agreed upon by the team members. So this particular section would allow for situations where there were documented and signed minutes or notes about changes to service to be considered an addendum to the individual service plan. Section 10 has to do with consumer risk, and we are asking that the State Quality Council be assigned two additional tasks within their assignment, and that would be to take a look at those things that are currently happening related to both personal and financial risk for individuals that may be limiting their choices for community options or services in the community. And the second would be to make recommendations back to the legislature in 2013. Section 11 basically incorporates a definition for community living settings. And again, this is language that we worked with the department on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pass this over.
Senator Higgins, would you like to ask a question now for Mr.
Actually, Mr. Lebeko answered.
Oh, he did. Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Turner or Mr. Nelson? Okay. Welcome. Senator. Oh, excuse me. Senator Sharon?
Yes. I would just like you to talk a little further about the difference between the service plan that you're talking about here and the plan talking about the counties that may not be in writing that you would be penalized for. Are those different plans?
Ms. Turner?
Thank you. It's the same plan. In the second situation, what we're doing is having documented meeting minutes be an addendum to that same plan. So the plan, it's the same plan that we're talking about, the service plan.
I see.
And
Ms. Senator Sharon?
And it may be not current because the county has not provided an updated version.
Correct. That's correct.
And then the second question, if you wouldn't mind,
Senator,
Madam Chair. I'm concerned about and I want you to talk with me about assurances that there is a lessening of the requirement in the background check for some unlicensed providers to align better with what's required of the licensed providers.
Ms. Turner?
And so I want you to talk to me about why that's in the best interest of the public as opposed to the best interest of a provider.
Thank you. We are initially, background studies were only requirements for licensed services, and there were people were able to do services in unlicensed situations without background studies. That changed to add background studies for all people, providing all services. So it actually wasn't, it was better, it was an improvement, but it didn't match up with the language that allows those background studies to be done on once, and then as long as the individual remains with that provider, they don't need a new background study unless they would leave that employer and go to another employer. So we were just trying to line that up with the way it's being handled for licensed services.
Senator Sharon.
I have to say that makes me a little anxious. I think in a licensed system, there's more oversight than an individual or an unlicensed system. So I'm very concerned that it that there's not a check in there for the possibility that from the time a background check is done, whether either system, and an action on a part of an employee that would create concern for the safety of the client, that it's not picked up. If there's not a repetitious or a periodic review of that background.
I think we added the language regarding the probation and correction officers that was given to us by licensing with the intent that that is the kind of mechanism that catches those things, so that if people do something that would be a disqualifying factor and they're in the system, if part of the reason is they have to do some licensed hours in a licensed setting, because that kind of connects them to that licensing system. And so they can't, if they don't do any licensed services, then this would not apply to them.
So, Sharon, just one more. I'm concerned about this. So are you saying to me then that this a section that relates to the probation agent's reporting, giving information, I think it is, their obligations, that they're going to have information about people working in these licensed or unlicensed centers, and that they're going to communicate them in a way that that prohibits them from serving the public? Ms. Turner?
Senator Sharon, Madam Chair, they would need to report back to the commissioner for individuals who are convicted who have been working in those kind of settings, yes.
Sarah, Sharon.
And then does the commissioner review that against those who are licensed or unlicensed providers? Where is the process that makes certain that that, in fact, has an impact?
Ms. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, if Mr. Kerber would come help me out here.
Mr. Kerber, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, and one of the areas I oversee is the licensing division where we do the background studies. And so the way this system works is we do background studies on people, and then we have to rely on something to find out if the person has been convicted of a new crime after we did that initial background study. In those cases where the person is employed with one of our licensed programs, there's a responsibility by the license holder who's likely going to know about a new conviction that the person has that's serious in nature, and they're obligated to tell us. The other part that the other requirement that we depend on is for the probation officers and corrections agents to report new convictions to us. So the way the system works now is at the time that somebody's convicted of a crime, the probation officer or the corrections agent has to ask the person, are you currently affiliated with any of these types of programs? And we provide forms for that they use. Are you affiliated with a DHS license program or health department, or do you do PCA services? Do you do child care? Any of those requirements, they go through the list, and if the person says, yes, I'm currently affiliated, then they report that information to us, and then we take a look at it, and then we see whether or not we've ever done a background study on that person and if that crime is relevant for purposes of disqualification. What happens in this case, then, that the requirement here that's being amended in is that for those programs, and the reason originally that when the background studies were extended beyond these licensed programs, that the services that are provided are sometimes quite informal, and they might only occur occasionally. And so the likelihood of somebody answering that question, yes, I'm affiliated with one of these programs, was pretty slim. And so the legislature said, well, for those people, it makes some sense to repeat that background study every year just to see if they've committed something new. What this bill is doing then is saying that in those cases where there's a provider that's got the continuum of services, it's both licensed and gets into this unlicensed area, and that same contact person is in place for all the background study purposes, that person is as long as they work 40 hours a week or 40 hours a year, when they're asked that question that's being amended here, no longer are you currently affiliated, but have you been affiliated in the last year, then they would have to answer that question yes. So then in theory, we should get that new information.
Sir, sure.
I've found that hard to follow, but I guess the bottom line I'm asking you, since you're responsible for this, is this system that's being described here adequate to assure that we know
whether it's licensed or unlicensed. Are we doing background checks often enough in order to do the best we can to reduce the risk? Are you satisfied that this language will accomplish that?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I think that this doesn't increase our risks. It's no more risky or no less risky than what we're doing now. What we have in the works is a system that will not rely on this other reporting. What we're trying to get established is to just routinely get new information from the court system about people who have been convicted of crimes. And then we'll sort through that and see, is this somebody that we care about because we've done a background study on them for a licensed program, for an unlicensed program, for any purpose. Did we ever do a background study on them? And then we'll look at, is that crime something we care about? So right now we're relying on humans to report things to us, and so it's probably not always perfect. This system doesn't make it really any less perfect than it is now. It sort of kind of expands our current system.
Thank you. Great. And thank you, Mr. Kerber. Yeah, thanks. Senator Nino, further testimony?
Well, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Weber. I'm the Chief Fiscal Analyst with ARM. I'll be doing Section 12, which is the voluntary closure adjustment that we're proposing. Basically, this section has kind of two duties. First, we ask the Commissioner to compile a report that kind of does an inventory of the overall corporate foster care system in the state and compares that to the number of folks in the system receiving those services to kind of get a gauge of whether or not our capacity of corporate foster care beds is near the correct level or too high or too low. If it's too high, then the commissioner can go ahead and create a process to have providers submit proposals to close facilities. In order to do that, they get an enhanced rate for 6 months, and then after the end of the 6 months, those folks are moved into alternative settings in the community, and the provider essentially gets an incentive to close that facility, so we bring our beds down into the level of the area, kind of the level of service that the population who gets those services needs. This is based on the kind of nursing home closure adjustment that we did to move folks out of facilities onto the elderly waiver program, and we're essentially modeling that idea with this section.
Weber is okay. Ms.
Madam
Turner.
Chair, I'm going to continue with Section 13. Section 13 opens up the flexibility for use of shelter needy funding, which is money that is a supplement for housing that's done for unlicensed settings, equivalent to GRH, group residential housing, which is done in licensed settings. There have been some restrictions on the size and number of people that can live in a living situation and use shelter needy funding, so we're trying to expand that. And we've included language that would incorporate a plan for providers to eventually transfer the lease to the individual. So in situations where people sometimes have problems getting a rental because of a background or bad credit, the provider would be kind of that interim leaseholder with a two-year end date to transition to that person unless there was an exception made by the commissioner. Section 14, I'm going to pass over to Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Mr.
I'll handle Section 14. We've talked a lot at ARM about ways we can inspire innovation, and it's our belief that innovation happens in the private sector, or if it's in government, often closest to the action, for example, counties. When we were going over the whole concept of the blueprint with Senator Hahn last September, he came up with an idea of having an entity that's outside the department primarily look at proposals from the private sector or from lead agencies to do things that might not absolutely fall in line with rules and regulations, and to make recommendations to the commissioner to try new things. And what inspired his thinking was when he was visiting a program in his district that had a number of people, 9 or 10 people, in a large apartment building. Each had their own unit. They shared staff that had a separate hub, if you will. And the cost of those services were far less than corporate foster care. Yet there was greater independence for the people. They thoroughly enjoyed their new freedoms, if you will, in our lives, and proud of their apartments. The problem was that it did bump up against the under one roof provisions of four people, no more than four in a setting. The provider went to the department and asked for permission to do this, and it was granted. The problem is that it's kind of hit and miss. That provider had a good relationship with the department. They knew his services and had a lot of faith in them, were very familiar with it, so it was okayed. Other folks come forward with ideas that there might not be that familiarity. So what we're doing here is trying to set up a system in which these proposals from the bottom up could be vetted and then ultimately recommended to the commissioner, who would have ultimate authority. One of the key proponents of this is permission to fail. We believe that if innovation is to work, if people are going to really try things, they have to have some permission that this might not work. So there's assurances in this section that people could go back to their prior services if the innovation didn't work.
And Mr. Nelson, that's exactly what I was talking about with Odyssey. And it's a program down in Fairmont that they've been making work, and it's half of the cost. Yeah. And it's a tremendous program, great successes. They were they give me a bi-yearly update, and it's very exciting. So I have the information coming down from my office, but but you're right. It does have to have some boundaries, and it has to have some reliability and accountability going forward. But there's definitely a need for this expansion or the ability to maneuver in this. Thank you, Senator Dienel, for letting me talk about Odyssey.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And when things are a little less intense, I'd love to talk to you about that.
That's right. Okay. Super. Sections 15 and 16.
Senator Madam Dienel. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Turner.
Cover those sections. Section 15 is language we worked with the department on to give some definition to home community-based settings for people with disabilities and what those settings would look like or what are acceptable for settings, trying to not discuss size as much as kind of what something looks like. And Section 16 is fairly straightforward. It's allowing billing for independent living services under the brain injury and CADI waivers to have a daily billing rate. Currently, those rates are only done in 15-minute increments. So for people who might need to utilize a significant amount of services, it would be quite a challenge to have to do that with 15-minute increments. So we're looking at doing daily rates that kind of then deliver a package of services to those individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Senator Nino. Any questions? Yes, Senator Sharon.
Yes, under Section 15, you're seeking a waiver. There's a request to seek a waiver. Is the waiver just generally needed because it's community-based services, or is your definition of community of an appropriate setting, the restrictions around the setting, is there something within that language that requires a waiver?
We're not requesting a waiver. We're simply putting definition of what living situations that are able to be utilized, the waivers able to be utilized in these living situations, trying to assure that we're not creating institution-like settings, but so that's what this language does, is put some kind of what do these look like as far as where they're located and how they're designed.
So, Sharon?
So it says an amendment to the waiver that's already in place. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, they would need to do a waiver if there's anything that's in conflict with this definition, yes.
Okay. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question would be for Mr. Nelson. If we could go back to Section 14, the task force. I had written on just notes to myself whether there is any type of a sunset and what is the cost. And online, page 21, line 1, it says, looks like twice a year we've got to have some kind of proposals or report. And so it looks to me like this task force goes on in ad infinitum. And then I look at the fiscal note, and it looks like we're going to have 1.5 FTEs in 2013, 2.5 2014, and 2015. So I guess my question is this task force going to go on forever? And what's it going to cost? And why do we need 1.5 FTEs next year and 2.5 thereafter?
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, that's a good question. We don't, when we were envisioning this process, that this would be a small group of folks who met not very often, that there would not be a need for intense administrative or staff support. Now, I went online this morning to see if there was a fiscal note. I didn't see one. Now I know there is one, and I don't have a copy. So to be able to answer more thoroughly, I would have to take a look at it. But I do think that is a good question for the department on their rationale behind that. We don't think it should cost money. We think that this is a vehicle through which the state will ultimately save money. As to a sunset of it, that would be your prerogative. I don't recall if we have sunset, if we have a time limit on this, but at some point in time, we probably wouldn't need it once the system is changed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you. Senator Nino, I would ask that maybe you delve into this issue a little bit. I candidly don't really like to see open-ended task force that, you know, literally don't have any kind of an ending date. Looks to me like it's going to cost us a bunch of money, and I have no idea whether or not that is appropriate or not. The other question, as long as I have the mic, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman, just in response to that, sure. This does, because of this Section 14, that it will have to go to State Gov. It does fall under the Sunset Commission guidelines also. But if you'd like, we could bring up Mr. Kerber or somebody to address the reason for 1.5 FTEs.
I would like that, Madam Chair.
Thank
please.
You. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator, I'm Alex Bartolik, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. We support the innovation, and we've talked about this before. This process, though, does require RFPs. When there are items that are approved, we may have to submit waiver amendments to our federal plan if what's being asked for is outside of that, and there are reporting. And then it's a cycle. So we start with one set of projects, and the next year, while those projects are continuing, we're adding another set. So that was the estimate we had of what it would take to support it. Good outcomes, a way to evaluate it, but it also, and the committee, the other people participating, are very valuable, but there still is work that's needed at the department to issue the RFPs and make changes in our federal plan as needed in order to support them.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Senator Nino, I guess my request would be is that, you know, I would guess eventually this is going to come to finance, and I would ask that you really take a look at this, because here again, if the department is correct and this task force is going to add FTEs and add costs, I really question the wisdom of it. The other thing I would like to ask you, Senator Nino, and I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, but if you could go to the original bill that was in our packet to the last page,
I do not have a copy of that. If I could have someone give me one.
I have a page bringing you one.
I'll look over your shoulder.
How's that for a promotion? Senator Nino, if you could go to Section 16 and Section 17 of the original bill, I see in there that there's a requirement that the commissioner eliminate duplicative and outdated standards, and then in 17, not impose limitations more restrictive than what would be required under the federal statutes. I'm not seeing that in the A3 amendment. Am I correct that those two sections did not survive and are not in the A3 amendment, and if so, why not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, Ms. Turner. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, those two sections did not make the current version of the bill. Section 16 in the original version had the commissioner working with the Department of Health to address any duplicative issues in regards to licensing or regulations. We felt we could approach it more effectively by taking some time this year to work on that issue within our agency to point out those things that we think are duplicative and bring those to the attention of the commissioner and the Department of Health and try and work it through next year. So rather than kind of having something broad and vague in this year's bill, we took that particular section out.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nino, I would request that you revisit this issue. I think it's a good idea to eliminate duplicative or outdated standards, and I also think that we should be mindful of the fact that there are federal mandates on us, and oftentimes the state agencies go past those federal mandates and have more restrictive rules and regulations on us than are necessary or required. So I would just simply ask Senator Nino that you go back and revisit that issue.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And I think it's pertinent to highlight, we're talking about the fiscal note and FTEs and such. The major portion, or the bill that creates the major impact in the fiscal note, I believe is Section 15. And I've heard the department has said that if we tighten up that language a little bit, we can eliminate the vast majority of the fiscal impact on this particular bill. I'm not sure, Madam Chair. I've heard differing messages as to whether we need to send this to state gov or not to state gov. If we do need to go to state gov, what I would request of the committee is that we move this bill out of this committee over to there with the understanding that it's likely going to have to come back here because of some resulting net fiscal impact. If we don't have to go to state gov, then the intent would be to lay this bill over so we can work out some of the details on that and then readdress that later. But either way, it seems highly likely that this committee is going to see the bill again at some point.
And, Senator, you know, to my knowledge, it does have to go to state gov. So, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I was going to point out on the fiscal note, page 6, the comment about the Section 15 being the major cost driver as well. I think my question is more on the innovation task force. It said it will review and make recommendations on pilot projects in home and community-based services that would be limited otherwise by state-imposed regulatory or funding restrictions. And I guess I'd ask, can you give us some examples of pilot projects that might fall under this, things that people have been thinking about over the past few years that are limited by those restrictions? I'm just kind of curious about what kinds of things might be coming to this task force to be considered.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Nelson, could you pull your microphone closer?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Nelson, excuse me.
Madam Chair, Senator
yes.
Higgins.
Thank you.
How's that? First off, what we're trying to do here is formalize something that, does happen, but there's no real designated process for it. It's sort of it depends upon who's the asker and, you know, the credibility, if you will, as a known entity in the department. So this is not establishing something that's entirely new. The example I used earlier was there were people living in corporate foster care.
I didn't hear that.
People who were living in corporate foster care. And who were high-functioning, people who had a desire to move into other settings, but they still did need services and supports and supervision on a fairly round-the-clock basis. But they were capable of being more integrated into the community, not only in going out during the day, but in their own living arrangements, and such as having their own apartment. There is a restriction right now that says that somebody who is providing the housing services, and it could be as the renter, and the support services, if you're the same entity, you can have no more than four, even in a very large building. We're all about integration, and nobody wants to take over an entire building for you know, a designated disability group or any group, whatever. But that limitation really was not cost-effective for the provider in order to open up and have more than four people in that apartment building, in an apartment building that had well over 100 other residents. So what the department did was say, okay, go ahead and do that. The provider, therefore, assuming some measure of liability, but go ahead and do that, and people could have their own apartments. They could receive their services not from somebody who is, you know, in that dwelling or in that, like in a group home, within a group home, but operated out of a hub in that same large apartment building. And so there was check-in, there was support, you know, throughout the day as people live their independent lives. That's an example of something that's much more cost-effective, much more liberating for people. And it did require permission from the department to do that.
And Senator Higgins, that's exactly what the Odyssey program is in Fairmont, and just a very innovative way to do that. These people, it's a case-by-case, individual-to-individual. They do not allow someone to live in this apartment unless they know that they have the skills, but they're still oversight, of course, and it's actually the system is built for their success instead of trying to fit these people into the standard system that we have already. They've expanded it, and I think right now to the state it's probably the standard living or customized living is probably 4,500 to 5,000 a month, I would say. And this is, and I don't have my notes, and I was hoping they would come down, but this is around $2,500 a month. It's a huge cost savings. And these people are so excited because they get to live in an apartment. And so this bill is basically expanding it to the, for Didi and Caddy, you said, basically? So it's expanding this measure. And is it going to work for everybody? It's an option. That's what I'm hoping for anyway.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wish I had my notes in front of me, Senator Higgins, because it's all off the top of my head. Any other further questions? How does everybody feel about sending this on to state.gov? And the fiscal note will be continued to be to work on, and then if it needs to come back, we can do that. Is that correct?
we'll need to come back.
Madam Chair,
come back.
If there's no further question, I would move that the bill, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to State Gov, with the understanding that unless we get that fiscal note down to zero, it's going to have to come back through here.
Sure. Absolutely. And I guess, Senator Nino, I'm sorry, Ms. Ring or Dr. Alice Hulbert, if they would like to testify.
Yes,
I'm sorry about that. But a motion has been made. Ms. Ring, welcome.
Trying to learn from everybody else and get it close enough. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Ring, and I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I have with me today Mike Calpiers, who's actually going to speak in a little more detail about the county concerns after I make just a couple of remarks. As you can hear, I'm a little bit under the weather, and this is an area that Mr. Calpiers has a lot more expertise in than I do. Counties do appreciate that this bill recognizes the need to move from outdated housing policies of 25 years ago to policies that reflect consumers' current needs and desires and that are consistent statewide and that are consistent with federal policies. However, as Mr. Nelson noted in his opening, counties were not one of the stakeholders that were at the table as the bill was developed. And as a result, we do have some concerns. And they mostly focus, I think, in Section 12 through 15 of the bill. But as I said, Mr. Calpiers will get into a little more detail with that. Depending on what the committee does decide, there was a fair amount of discussion about the Innovations Task Force. As you know, counties are very interested in innovation these days. We've been talking to you a lot about our ideas for redesign. And if you do decide to move forward with that task force, the one request we would have is that there's a little expanded county role in the task force. I think it does name one county representative. We usually find it works best if we have someone who represents the rural area and someone who represents the metro area. And I think that's something we can work on with ARM and with Senator Nino. But I'm going to turn to Mike Calpiers to dive a little bit more into Section 12 and a couple of the other sections at
this
time.
Thank you, Ms. Ring. Mr. Calpiers.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Mike Calpiers, and I am the Adult Foster Care Licensing Supervisor for Hennepin County. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak today and to provide some feedback and insight. I do echo what Ms. Ring just stated, that by working together in a cooperative environment, we will meet the results that we are all trying to achieve for the consumers who rely on us. Overall, I'd like to state that the counties bear the most responsibility in providing adequate services for its most vulnerable citizens. Social workers and other county staff work diligently to find and acquire services for these individuals. Likewise, counties are responsible for finding appropriate and adequate residential placements for some of the hardest to place consumers. I'd like to address the closure or downsizing of adult foster homes that is being addressed in this bill. I view the closure of adult foster care homes in the same light as the downsizing closure of nursing home facilities. In that process, counties were informed and involved in the various steps of the nursing home downsizing process, yet it's difficult to even begin to compare the population that is served in the four-bed adult foster homes to those who are being served in nursing homes. In reviewing this proposal, I believe that county input and involvement is minimized and rarely mentioned. Consider the fact that adult foster care was developed to bring individuals back into the community, moving them out of warehouse facilities like large ICFMRs and state-run institutions. That was a well-planned and worked-out project at that time, and involvement and cooperation involved extensive county support throughout the state of Minnesota. Because of that, numerous people thrived in their environments and in their homes. Without adequate involvement, input, resources, and safety nets, counties will lose valuable opportunities for those with extreme mental health needs, traumatic brain injuries, high behaviors, and more. We understand that excellent alternatives are being developed and put into place for those who have the ability
to function in a more independent environment. Personally, I believe very strongly that these opportunities should be available to those who could benefit from them. However, for those with higher needs, such as fire starters, mentally ill individuals, and those individuals who need the high level of support that adult foster care offers, safety nets are virtually non-existent, and hospital and RT settings are already overburdened. Also, many of these individuals lack family to assist in any type of planning or support and depend on their counties in order to just maintain. Adequate alternatives are not in place for those consumers with the highest needs, and social workers continue to struggle to find adequate residential resources. I can tell you about two consumers who lost their residential services since I testified last Tuesday. One was hospitalized because the provider could no longer meet his medical needs, and the other was evicted from her apartment program. With regards to the individual in the apartment program, it is uncertain how the lease arrangement affects the consumer, and the situation has become very complicated in a short period of time. At this point, neither individual has any potential residential alternatives. Another area I'd like to address is the voluntary closure of adult foster care homes. As the language currently stands now, counties have little input on provider proposals or the review process. Counties have the potential of losing valuable residential resources for its consumers, while more marginal service providers could remain in place. More consideration must be given to counties who have the expertise in working with the adult foster care providers. Without our input, decisions would be made without a valuable knowledge base currently in place. Likewise, I believe it is not a responsible use of state dollars to pay providers to close. In some instances, marginal or poor performance may be looked at as being rewarded by providing this type of buyout. Even with this rate adjustment, the communities as a whole may lose as well. Adult foster care providers have become an integral part of many communities and neighborhoods, and residents have been truly accepted as members of those communities. With many communities already devastated by multiple foreclosures, where does this actually leave the property if these homes were to close? Does the provider, or in many cases the private owner, try to sell, or do they just walk away from these properties? In closing, I'd like to mention that the daily per diem rate right now for Anoka Regional Treatment Center is $1,038. Eliminating adult foster care resources, where many of these consumers are discharged to, backs up the system and can cost counties up to $519 a day when the treatment facility has determined that it is clinically appropriate for the client to be discharged. The $519 comes directly from property tax dollars. Furthermore, we are just asking that counties be involved and immersed in a cooperative manner in order to represent consumers in a positive manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Calpiers. And Ms. Ring, any questions for the two? Any comments, Senator Nino? Oh, Senator Lord.
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask Senator Nino if he had any response to, I mean, is there a reason counties weren't at the table in the discussion, considered a stakeholder, and just maybe respond to this criticism that was just levied, if you would.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, I didn't facilitate the discussions and negotiations on this particular proposal. That was handled mostly by the representatives from ARRM, so I don't have a direct answer to that. They might. I don't know if they want to speak to that or not.
And I'd be happy to jump in, Madam Chair and Senator Lurie. Since the bill was introduced and heard over in the House, we have been in consultation and conversation with Mr. Nelson, and we will start the conversation now. But since there was sort of a list of stakeholders given at the beginning that was consulted, as it was as the bill was developed. We wanted to point out that the reason you're hearing from us today is we weren't involved and able to address these concerns until now. Senator Lori?
I wonder, do you see enough value in the rest of the bill and enough mm-hmm. common ground that you think that between here and state and local, you know, if you're fully engaged, you can get to a place of agreement? I mean, I think that's what we're all hoping for is win-wins. And by bringing people to the stakeholders, that's how these bills traditionally have either succeeded or failed. And I hope to see success on good reforms like this. And so do you have some confidence that you'll be able to work together and find the common ground?
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, you know, I think we intend to engage really fast, and I think there are areas that are easier than others. I think it depends. Some of our concerns about the voluntary closure of adult foster homes is something that may be fundamental to the bill, and our concern is that we continue to have the resources that we need in our community for the folks that have the highest degree of need that are not easy to place in other ways. And we have some concerns about how that piece would move forward. Some of the other concerns may be things where there's that are less fundamental to the bill where we can find more room to negotiate. But until we have those conversations, I can guarantee you that we will work hard to find a compromise, and we'll let you know as soon as possible.
And Ms. Ring, that it is, as you said, it's a voluntary closure. So I think it's important to come to the table. But Senator Higgins, I was right on with this odyssey. It was 45 to 5,000 a month per person. There is, yeah, and Odyssey saves them. They're down to 2,200 a month per person. So that's a huge savings. And, of course, they did engage the county and going forward. But it is a very successful program. And, of course, it has its limits because it is case by case. And you have to adjust this waiver for the particular person. But there's so much potential here. I'm very excited about it. But there's some work that needs to be done on the bill. Senator Need now. Senator Lori.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just following in that vein, I mean, are you envisioning kind of I believe that the counties have a role, like when we do planned closures for beds in the nursing homes, and they look at the community needs and things, and they mm-hmm. have a role. I don't know what the statute book actually says as far as their role, but I know that they're consulted and their opinion is sought. I don't know if it's a veto power that they have or exactly how it is, but we have kind of a template where because I've been through some of these in my communities as well. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that works well, or is that kind of what you're talking about? It would be my question.
Right. Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Lori, that is what we're seeking, and I think if there's openness to having a county role in that process, that would go a long way toward satisfying our concerns.
Fair enough.
On that section.
Further questions for the two? Further questions for Senator Nino? The motion is on the table.
Madam Chair, is there...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Someone else
we have
wants
another
to speak
person.
To the bill.
I am just not firing here. Dr. Alice Holbert, please.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'm glad you waved.
Thank you for the opportunity to
You're
testify
welcome.
On this important topic. My name is Alice Holbert. I'm a parent of a child who's 26. He's not a child, who has recently moved to a group home. And I've only just become aware of this bill, so I apologize that I'm coming in so late. But many parents are now becoming aware of this bill. The word is spreading, and there's more and more of us, and we have serious concerns with a lot of the issues in the bill. It's not going to be an opportunity for people to choose a new living arrangement. It's a forced opportunity. They're not being given a choice if you read Section 12. And that's a major problem for us. There were no parents of people with disabilities on the task force or whatever came up with this. They had some advocacy organization representation, but there is no substitute for how a parent sees a service and how it affects their family member. And I think from the start, there should have been some people who had a member living in a group home as a part of this discussion. I'll just look at the bill quickly. I don't have the amended version that came out, but it's pretty similar to the one that I have. So I'll just quickly read through a couple of the sections that we have concerns about. I think in the second section where you're increasing to a fifth bed, it's being touted as well, we will make sure people know there's a fifth bed when we bring them into the house. The problem is that there's a shortage of group home beds. So if the only one that's open is in a house which has a fifth respite care bed and you need a spot, you don't really make informed consent to put your child living in that condition. I see my son as just like my other children. So if I was sending him to a college where the dorm allowed extra people to be moved into his room whenever they felt like it, I don't think that's a very good quality accommodation for him. I understand the pressures to find respite space, and I would suggest at least under those conditions, the per diem rate for the people who are the permanent residents would be temporarily decreased during the time that a respite person was moved into their house. They'll be sharing an extra person in their bathroom and an extra person eating their food and fighting over what to watch on TV. So out of a respect for a person, they should at least be charged less rent. A lot of these people are earning their own money to pay the partial rent, you know. So it's really unfair to change the living arrangements like that and not at least let them have some financial benefit from it. The other concern, I am an ex-city council member from Edina, and, you know, the other concern is the use in a single-family neighborhood. What is acceptable? I'm very conscious of group homes and their interactions in neighborhoods. You've got a house with four adults and possibly three staff living in a single-family neighborhood, claiming they're not a business, and I'm okay with that. But to increase it to five and maybe even additional staff, and then the neighbors don't know who's coming and going because they're on respite every 2 weeks, it's a little unsettling. I don't know that that's necessarily fair to expand that amount of disruption into single-family neighborhoods and say it's an acceptable use. I'll mainly work on section, well, now let us see what I found here. Oh, I'm a little concerned about the State Quality Council and also the Innovation Task Force. I agree with your questions about cost. But the other thing is that there are so few family members represented, and so the actual people who will be affected by this are not having a voice. I think it's 13 members on those committees and only one family member. I don't know why they're not half family members, especially with the Innovative Task Force. You know, parents actually do have some good ideas that could help improve services and come up with some different living arrangements if they were ever consulted. But our major concern is with Section 12, and it's not a voluntary closure. It's only voluntary for the provider. According to this rule, providers would be paid to become unlicensed. They would not be asking their clients what they thought about this change in service. It would just be a direct money transfer to them if they would agree to close. And they would then inform the residents of their relocation plan. Well, that's kind of treating the residents like dogs. We're going to take you and relocate you to this other place down the road. These people may have lived in this setting for 10 or 15 or more years. They have friends, they have a church, they have a job. If they're relocated to another place, how do they maintain their support and possibly their income? There's nothing in here that states that they need to remain in the same community so at least they can hold on to their job. I think there needs to be some sort, there are plenty of variances written into this piece of legislation. We need some variances for the residents from the requirements of this, that if they're facing hardship with loss of family support, loss of community, loss of jobs by their relocation plan, they can appeal this decision or at least be given information about other providers in the community. They're being treated like some sort of chattel which are owned by the providers, and their only choice will be the provider-created plan, which will be, of course, to move them to another provider-owned facility. So it really is treating them in a pretty disrespectful manner, as if they have no feelings or any right to having choice in their life. I find it very, very concerning.
Ms. Holbert, we would like to allow time for the department if they would like to respond to some of these questions.
Okay.
And then we do have to have a vote or questions for you, too. So
that's our major concern. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And
I apologize for,
I should probably say my situation is I have a 26-year-old son. He's very involved and needs a lot of support. When we looked for a group home, the only house that would take him was in Elk River, and we live in Edina, so we would not have been able to support him. So we bought a house, and we are renting it to a group home provider who's operating it as an unlicensed group home. And in a worst-case scenario, someone could come along and say, this house has, our provider has decided to close this house, and you're going to be relocated. So all of the investment that we've put into this to support our son would be lost, and he could be moved to the Elk River location with really no process. Thank you.
Thank you. If you don't mind just staying there, Dr. Holbert.
Okay.
Dr. Kerber or Mr. Nelson, if there's any response or any questions from the committee? Or Dr. Holbert? Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Holbert.
Thank you. Oops. Sorry.
Ms. Bartolik, please.
Madam Chair, I wasn't too sure if there was a question specifically you had for the department or if...
If you had any response or your definition of some of the concerns that were raised by the previous witness.
We have worked with ARM and with the different representatives about how to look at a process. I understand that the voluntary closure by a provider would raise questions for people, but I think the other component of it was how can we do a need determination process and really understand what capacity is out there and how to better match resources with people's needs is an important component of that. And with a plan, there also could be indications of whether people are comfortable with that or there are other options. So I think there's ways of working through the language to try to make sure that the people who are living there and their families and the counties are also engaged in the planning process.
So, Ms. Bartolik, you would be willing to continue the work on this to give some comfort language, and could you pull your microphone a little bit closer, too? Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, we will continue working on
okay.
the language.
That'd be great. Mr. Nelson,
Madam Chair, thank you for calling us back up. Just a couple comments. Number one, the bill is loaded with language around informed consent, such as with the respite provision, with the 5-bed provision. The thrust of what we're trying to do is to facilitate consumer choice. Now, sometimes the consumer's choice isn't the same as the family's choice, but you know, there is a connection there that what we're trying to facilitate is opening up the world to and that is now much constituted around corporate foster care, which is the perfect situation for a lot of people. But there are a lot of people at their own choice may want to move into another setting with a different services. We have language in the bill that makes we allow for transition for the housing provider to be the same as the service provider, but forcing that provider to turn over control, for example, of the housing to the consumer. I think that there's a misunderstanding of where we're trying to go. If there are things in here that are contrary to that, we certainly are willing to look at those and talk about them.
I appreciate that, Mr. Nelson, and I do think the consumer's voice does need to be respected and listened to for the department and for ARM. Any further questions? A motion is on the table that Senate file 1699 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to State Gov. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Senator Higgins, do you have a question?
With the caveat it needs to come back.
With the caveat that it needs to come back. All those in favor, say aye. Let's do that again.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment to, or the bill is sent on. Thank you, Senator Nienow. Members, we are coming back here to this room at 6:30 tonight. We have a long agenda, as you can tell. And see you later. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I'm